Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and this week we're doing a deep dive into Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. All right, my friends, we are four movies into our deep dive into the Friday the 13th series, and four movies to go, starting with this one, Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. Now, in all, like, the posters and marketing for this film, its title is Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning. But in the actual opening credits, it doesn't say Part 5, it just says A New Beginning. So that is how I'm going to be sticking to it. And I like that because it comes off of the fourth movie, which is just called Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. And now we have the next movie is A New Beginning. Now, the fourth movie was supposed to be the final chapter, but like all the Friday the 13th movies before it, it made a lot of money. Executive producer Frank Mancuso Jr. has said that what would happen when they would make a Friday the 13th movie is that the movie would come out on a Friday, have its opening weekend, make a lot of money, and on a Monday, Frank Mancuso Jr. would get a call from a Paramount executive who had seen the numbers and would literally just say, go make another one. And that was it. So that is what they did. And of course, at the end of the final chapter, Jason Voorhees is dead. Dead, 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 for real and for true, dead. So this movie, A New Beginning, was supposed to be literally that, a new beginning for the franchise, a new antagonist with the character of Tommy Jarvis, played by Corey Feldman, gradually becoming Jason. There's a problem, though. Corey Feldman, after having, you know, the two movies in 1984, The Final Chapter, and Gremlins, Corey Feldman's career really blew up, justifiably so, and he was filming a little movie called The Goonies, directed by Steven Spielberg, when Friday the 13th, A New Beginning was going to be shot. The original plan was that Corey Feldman was going to be the lead in A New Beginning, but because of his commitments to The Goonies, they had to do some rewriting. Corey Feldman was only able to do a cameo in the film at the very, very beginning. And Corey Feldman, because The Goonies shooting schedule was very, very intense, only had one day off from shooting The Goonies per week. That was on a Sunday. So that was the day where he filmed his cameo for Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. And they actually filmed the cameo at Corey Feldman's house in his backyard using a rain machine. Filmed it in one day. And Corey Feldman has since expressed deep, deep regret that he was not able to continue on as Tommy Jarvis in a larger role. But The Goonies is a pretty famous movie in its own right, so I think things turned out well for him either way. Now, for A New Beginning, Frank Mancuso Jr. took a less hands-on approach to this film, you know, a role as executive producer rather than producer, to sort of, you know, put, you know, still oversee things, but, you know, put things in other people's hands and see what would come of it. They hired Danny Steinman to direct this movie. Let's talk about Danny Steinman. Very excited to do so. Danny Steinman's first film credit was in 1973, a movie called High Rise. And High Rise was a hardcore porn movie. And Danny Steinman has said that he wanted to basically remake Deep Throat, but do it better. He was very, very ambitious. Then in 1980, Danny Steinman directed a slasher movie called The Unseen about three female reporters who are covering the Danish festival in a California town. They choose to stay in this creepy looking old Victorian mansion where there's something unseen in the basement that starts hunting them. And after that, Danny Steinman directed in 1984 a movie called Savage Streets, an exploitation film which has since become a cult classic, but it was really lambasted at the time. But Savage Streets stars Linda Blair, who won the Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Actress for her performance. So that is Danny Steinman's like major filmography up to this point. Hardcore porn, slasher movie, and exploitation film. That sounds like a perfect pedigree for a Friday the 13th director, for me, anyway. I totally understand why Danny Steinman was hard based on that resume. Makes a lot of sense. And knowing that those are the films he'd made before this, it really makes sense that the movie that we're going to watch tonight is what it is. Also, a reason that this movie is the way it is that allegedly, according to several sources, actors and crew who are on the film, allegedly, Danny Steinman spent a huge amount of the filming process for Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, high on cocaine. And there was actually allegedly, a lot of hardcore drug use on this film by multiple people, not just Danny Steinman. And again, I think that really makes sense. Like, this is a movie that feels like it was made on cocaine. And I actually highly recommend watching this movie using the recreational substance of your choice. Preferably not cocaine or anything like that, but something more harmless and less addictive than that, but might enhance your experience of Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. Just saying, but be safe, my friends. Don't do anything stupid. Now, this is actually Danny Steinman's last film. He had five other movies lined up that he was going to make after Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, including a sequel to Wes Craven's The Last House on the Left. But shortly after this movie came out, Danny Steinman was in a really, really bad bicycle accident that almost killed him. And he spent years recovering, gaining his physical well-being back. And sadly, never made another movie, despite many attempts to do so. Never made another film. Passed away in 2012. Rest in peace, Danny Steinman. This is also the first film in the Friday the 13th series that actually uses the full name Jason Voorhees. He's always referred to as just Jason in the first four movies, but this movie, the fifth one, they finally say, put it together, they say Jason Voorhees. This movie was filmed under a false title, as several of the Friday the 13th movies were. Both written and cast and started and filmed under the title of Repetition. And the cast members actually did not know that they were acting in a Friday the 13th movie until the first day of filming, most of them, when they saw the actor playing Jason literally walk by. And that's when a lot of them realized that, oh my God, we're in a Friday the 13th movie. And some of them found that to be really, really exciting news. Some people were not excited that they were in a Friday the 13th movie. Chief among them, John Shepherd, who is sort of technically, I guess, the male lead in this film. John Shepherd plays the adult version of Tommy Jarvis, Corey Feldman's character. And John Shepherd was a method actor. He actually spent several months volunteering at a mental hospital as research for the character of Tommy, since Tommy Jarvis, of course, has grown up and is deeply traumatized by the events that he experienced in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. He was not happy that it turned out to be a Friday the 13th movie, but he still gave it his all. Good for him. And this is an interesting film, again, because we're breaking the format. It is a whodunit, like the first Friday the 13th movie is, because in the first movie, you don't know, if you've never seen it, obviously, you don't know who the killer is. You know, it's about who could it be? Could it be this character? Could it be that? And A New Beginning goes back to that again, because, again, Jason Voorhees is dead. but someone is killing all these people wearing a hockey mask. And a big clue is that Jason's hockey mask, for most of this movie, has blue diamonds on it, which Jason's real hockey mask in the first four films has red diamonds on it. So that is a clue that this is not the actual Jason. This is someone else doing the killing. And I'm just gonna talk about this later, but I'll talk about it now. There is a lot of hatred directed towards this movie by the Friday the 13th fandom because it's not actually the real Jason Voorhees doing the killing in this film. Technically, that is a spoiler, but I'm going to just put it out there just to try and mitigate your potential disappointment. It's not the real Jason Voorhees doing the killing in A New Beginning, because it's A New Beginning, right? It is someone else, and the mystery of this movie is who could it be doing this stuff? And I think A New Beginning really gets a bad rap from a lot of people. You know, even though it's not the real Jason Voorhees, watching this movie, if you didn't know that, and some of you might not know that, but now you do, but you enjoy the movie, right? Until the end, when you find that out, and we'll talk about that later. So producers wanted a kill or a jump scare every 8 or 9 minutes in this movie, and Danny Steinman obliged. And they also wanted more nudity because, again, this came out in 1985, so the slasher genre in the 1980s is kind of reaching its peak at this point. There's a lot of competition out there, so how do we keep Friday the 13th as a franchise on top, especially now in 1985? A Nightmare on Elm Street has come out the year previous, you know, introducing Freddy Krueger into the nightmares of generations of folks. So Friday the 13th really had to do something different to, you know, stay at the top, which is really why this movie is the way it is. And this movie has the most nudity by far of any film in the franchise. A lot of nudity. And a lot of kills as well. We'll talk about that later. But it's more kills than any movie thus far as well. There were 16 different scenes in this film that had to be drastically trimmed in order to secure an R rating from the MPAA. And one of my favorite quotes about this movie, Danny Steinman, the director, later said, and this is a quote, "I shot a fucking porno in the woods. You wouldn't believe how much nudity they cut out." So Danny Steinman also, because there's this mandate that there has to be a kill or scare every 8 minutes or so, this is a movie that really, it doesn't necessarily focus on the core group of people at the summer camp or summer camp-esque thing like the previous four movies have. There are, I would say, half of the cast of this movie, if not more than that, are characters that are literally introduced into the movie to be murdered. Literally, like, there are characters that they get 3 or 4 minutes to establish themselves, and then they die in really interesting ways. So that's a change of tack for the Friday the 13th franchise. And it's kind of the opposite of a lot of the previous movies where, you know, not all, but in most of the first four movies, there is some, like, good character development. You know, if not with every character, at least with some core characters you really develop an attachment to, and you're sorry to see them die. This movie is the absolute opposite of that. There is, like, zero character development in this film at all. Everyone is cardboard. Everyone is a type. Most of them are just introduced to get killed. And you might think that I might not like that because of the way I've talked about the previous four movies. But I actually really love A New Beginning for that, because it just totally commits. Like, we are just going to make this a crazy, nonstop, batshit insane kill fest with a lot of tits. And there's a place for that too. It really feels like a sleazy, trashy, you know, underground horror movie from the 1970s in a way. And I mean that as a compliment, but very, very different in feel from the previous films, which was exactly the point. You know, this movie is exactly what it says on the tin. It is a new beginning. It is something new. It is something different. Way more killing, with a lot more nudity, a lot. This movie is a lot. And I love it. I really do. And I hope you're going to enjoy it too. Let's talk a little bit about the cast. I'm only going to talk about some of the cast members in this introduction. And I'll talk about others as they're introduced in the film. I'll talk about some of the most prominent ones to begin with. And I'm going to start with Tom Morga, who plays Jason, or the Jason-esque person. And Tom Morga is really special in a way, because he is the only actor who has played Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers, and Leatherface. Tom Morga plays Jason throughout this entire movie, except for the very opening sequence, starring Corey Feldman. John Hawk, another stuntman actor, plays Jason in that very first scene. But other than that, Tom Morga is Jason throughout the rest of the film when he's masked. And Tom Morga played Michael Myers for the first half of Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. Probably the second best Halloween movie, if I had to rank them. I like Halloween 4 quite a bit. It's the only movie other than the first Halloween that I think really captures the flavor of the holiday itself, but I digress. And Tom Morga played Leatherface in one single scene in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So Tom Morga, very special, has played three of the great horror killer icons: Jason, Michael Myers, and Leatherface. And we've talked about him a little bit, but we have John Shepherd, who plays the adult Tommy Jarvis, all grown up, very, very traumatized. Interestingly enough, he doesn't speak a lot. Tommy doesn't in this movie. He only says about 24 words throughout the entire course of this film. And it's really a credit to John Shepherd as an actor that, despite barely speaking, he really does make an impression as Tommy. You can really see what he's thinking. And you can tell that John Shepherd as an actor is really putting his all into it, even though it turned out to be a Friday the 13th movie and not the movie he thought it was going to be. For his audition, he, again, method actor here, for better or for worse. For his audition, he went into the audition for Danny Steinman, and, you know, in an audition, they ask you, like, hi, what's your name? What are you going to do for us? All that. And John Shepherd didn't speak. He did not look at Danny Steinman. He just sat down and looked very troubled and was like fidgeting with his clothes, like basically being the character that's in the script. And luckily, Danny Steinman got what John Shepherd was doing and hired him. Now, also we have Melanie Kinneman as Pam. And it's interesting, sharing the same first name as Mrs. Voorhees, whose first name is Pamela, as it became canon in the previous movie. Now we have Melanie Kinneman as goes by Pam. She is one of the actors who did not get along with Danny Steinman, the director. She said that on one of very early on into filming, may have even been the first day, that she asked Danny Steinman, you know, how about a scene, like, how should I do this? And he snapped at her and said, just do it. And Melanie said, like, that's when she realized, okay, I'm on my own here. I am just going to do the best job that I can. Because she realized she was not going to get the kind of direction from Danny Steinman that she was expecting to get. We have Shavar Ross as Reggie the Reckless, who is, I think, probably really the only character in this movie that really makes a giant impression and that you really root for and care about. Shavar Ross as Reggie the Reckless is great in this movie. I love his performance. He, child actor, of course, was a recurring character on the TV shows Different Strokes, also Family Matters, has many, many, many other television credits on his resume. Eventually left acting to become a pastor and started his own ministry. We also have Debbie Sue, as she was credited in this film. Debbie Sue, but now goes by Deborah Voorhees as Tina. This is, as we've talked about, this franchise likes to reuse names. This is the second Tina in the franchise. There was a Tina in the last movie, in Final Chapter. One of the twins was named Tina. We got another Tina, played by Deborah Voorhees. And the casting agents were really, really interested in her immediately when they saw her resume, obviously because of her last name, Voorhees. She had been a Playboy bunny and did some acting roles, but eventually became a teacher. And years later, was actually fired from teaching at a school because some students at the school had figured out that she was in this movie, in which she does have extended nudity, and brought pictures of her nudity in the film to school and passed them around. And this got to the attention of the administration, and they fired Deborah Voorhees for appearing naked in a movie like 20 years earlier. America, folks. We also have, interesting thing about the role of Tina. There's a lot of people that auditioned for this part, actually. So Darcy DeMoss, who appears very briefly in the final chapter as one of the, girls in the Aerobicize video, she auditioned for Tina, and was very close to getting the part. But before he gave her the part, Danny Steinman, the director, asked her in the audition to take her shirt off and show him her breasts, which she refused to do. She said, "I'm going to have to talk to my agent like that about that." And she got notified the very next day from the production team that her services were no longer required. But Darcy DeMoss is not done with Friday the 13th. We'll see her again soon, but not in this one. Gina Gershon also auditioned for the role of Tina. Gina Gershon, also, you know, of course, famous for the movie Bound with Jennifer Tilly and for the glorious camp piece of beautiful trash, Showgirls, giving the best performance in that movie, actually. Gina Gershon in Showgirls is the only actor who knows exactly what movie she's in. Deborah Voorhees has also written and directed film as well, and very recently in 2021, she directed and starred as a fictional version of herself in a movie called 13 Fanboy, and which is about what you might expect it to be about, a fanboy of a slasher movie franchise stalking and killing women who have been in that franchise. And 13 Fanboy, directed by Deborah Voorhees, who plays Tina in A New Beginning. 13 Fanboy also has amongst its cast Tiffany Helm, who appears in Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, in the character of Violet, who has a great dance scene later on in the movie. Tiffany Helm also appeared in an episode of the TV show Freddy's Nightmares, which some may remember fondly. I believe it's on streaming on Tubi. It's never been officially released on DVD or Blu-ray, but I think it's on Tubi, and yeah, you can find it online if you look hard enough. Sherilyn Fenn also auditioned for the role of Violet, and Sherilyn Fenn, of course, would later go on to fame playing the role of Audrey Horne in Twin Peaks, aka my favorite TV show ever made. This movie was edited by Bruce Green, and Bruce Green was the assistant editor to the Oscar-winning editor Michael Caine, who did, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and the producers and director of A New Beginning weren't quite sure about if they wanted to hire Bruce Green because he had lots of great assistant editor credits, but not a lot of editor credits in his own right. And to help convince them, Michael Kahn said to the producers that if they did not like Bruce Green's work, he would take over and edit the movie for free for them. Oscar-winning editor editing a Friday the 13th movie. Wouldn't that be something? But Bruce Green did a great job, so that did not happen. Now, Friday the 13th, A New Beginning. Okay, we're back to the timeline stuff. This movie is set 5 years after Friday the 13th, the final chapter, because if you remember, in the final chapter, Tommy Jarvis is 12 years old. In A New Beginning, Tommy Jarvis is 17 years old, even though John Shepard definitely looks older than that. But they all look older than the teenagers they're supposed to be. But, with all the nudity going around, that's a good thing. So that means that Friday the 13th, A New Beginning is set in 1989. We're in the future again. The Friday the 13th, the final chapter, is the only movie in this entire franchise that actually takes place in the year the movie was actually released in the real world. All the other movies are either a year before, in the case of the first Friday the 13th, or several years in the future. And now we're in 1989. So in A New Beginning, it has been 10 years since the original film. In the world of Friday the 13th. So it came out in 1985, set 1989. Not confusing at all, but that's part of the fun here. All right, let's get to... We're almost ready to start this crazy journey. So let's go over the body count. The body count for Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, is 22. This movie is 92 minutes long. And there are 22 murders in it, which, if you do the math, I didn't do the math. Someone else on the internet who is better at math than I did the math. That means that, on average, there's a kill every, 4 minutes in A New Beginning. Only Jason Goes to Hell and Jason X have a higher body count than this movie. Now, here's some of the methods of murder here. We're getting very creative now in terms of how we kill people. So we have machete to stomach, throat, chest, an ice pick to the neck, axe to the chest, axe to the head, road flare in the mouth, knife to the stomach, knife to the throat, garden shears through eyes, head crushed with leather strap against a tree, spear through the chest in an outhouse, meat cleaver decapitation, a cleaver to the face through a window, railroad spike through the head, eye gouging. This is really the movie where Jason Voorhees totally makes the machete his weapon of choice. Sure, a machete is used as a murder weapon in the previous four movies, but A New Beginning is the one where, Jason almost always has the machete, which will continue on. And I give Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, a rating of 3 machetes. A rating that I'm sure is higher than a lot of Friday the 13th and other horror fans would put this movie. But again, watch this movie as if it's for the first time. And just enjoy the wild and crazy ride that this is. We're going to have a lot of fun, my friends. All right, I hope you got your popcorn ready and your recreational whatever of choice, should you choose to do so safely and legally. And get ready. We're going to have fun watching this crazy, batshit insane Friday the 13th movie. There is no other Friday the 13th movie quite like this one, and that's what makes it special. All right, we are going to watch until it gets 23 minutes into the movie, when you're going to see a fade to white. So see you in 23 minutes, my friends. Okay, so as all the best horror movies do, we begin with a very dramatic thunderstorm scene. And it's Corey Feldman in a yellow rain slicker and his glasses, looking very, very terrified as two morons decide, hey, you know what would be a good idea? Let's dig up Jason Voorhees. I do love that the tombstone of Jason Voorhees, his name is like spray painted on it. Looks very creepy. And I also love that they choose to dig up a grave in the pouring rain, which of course is turning the soil into mud, which makes it a lot harder to dig. But they finally do get, they reveal, you know, Jason in his grave. And again, it is John Hawk playing the role of Jason in this scene, in this sequence with Corey Feldman. And they actually dumped a big bucket of live worms all over his body and face for this film. So those worms you're seeing on him crawling around, those are real. He is in that mask having the worms just crawl all over him. I also find it hilarious that whoever buried Jason buried him in the hockey mask, very considerate, but they also bury Jason with a machete, and not just a machete, they bury him with an ice pick as well, and we have two people dead, killed by Jason, within 3 minutes and 45 seconds of this film, so... It tells you right away, you know, what kind of movie that we're going to be watching here. We're not starting off slow. No. And when this film was first released, audiences actually erupted in cheers when Jason gets out of the grave and advances toward poor Corey Feldman, who is contorting his face into just these expressions of anguish. But then it's all a dream. Instead of a dream sequence at the end, we're starting with a dream sequence. And we smash cut to, it's been 5 years since the events of the final chapter, and Tommy Jarvis is in a van being driven to a place we know that There's some kind of mental institution thing going on, because the van has a grate in the back, and also the guy in the passenger seat of the van, you see him reading a porn magazine. You can see the nude pictures. So really, at the very beginning of this movie, you know, you have kills almost immediately, and then you have guys reading a porn mag with the nudie. Like, that tells you what this movie's going to be about. Again, like I said, it is about blood and tits. Friday the 13th, A New Beginning is. I love the credits too. It starts off with the original logo from the first Friday the 13th movie, and then it is exploded by Jason's mask. And it says a new beginning, and again that mask has blue diamonds on it, not red. Clue from the opening credits that this Jason is not who he appears to be. Martin Becker did the special effects, makeup, and gore effects for this film, by the way. Shout out to him. The screenplay is written by David Cohen and director Danny Steinman, but Martin Kittrosser also gets a credit for this script because they recycle an unused idea. So Friday the 13th Part 3 was originally supposed to be about the character of Ginny, played by Amy Steele, who's the final girl at the end of Part 2. Part 3 was supposed to be about Ginny, as I talked about, being in a psychiatric institution, being stalked by Jason, traumatized by the events that she experienced with him. They didn't end up making the movie about that, but so they reused it for A New Beginning, or used enough elements of that concept that Martin Kittrosser gets a credit for it. Now we are introduced to our new setting here, the idyllic Pinehurst Youth Development Center. And heading that the Pinehurst Youth Development Center is Richard Young as Dr. Matthew Letter. He has a sign in his office that I, if you pause, you can read it. It says, "Help destroy a family tradition. Prevent child abuse." So I don't know how I feel about that, but I figured it was worth noting. So Richard Young, who plays Dr. Letter, originally started a pre-dentistry program at the University of Washington, but also got interested in doing photography and decided to drop the whole being a dentist thing and moved to California to become a cameraman, and actually was hired to work crew for the legendary producer and director Roger Corman. And the film they were working on had an actor who never showed up to the set. So Richard Young ended up starring in the Roger Corman movie Night Call Nurses. That started his acting career. He had huge amount of film and TV credits, but he decided to quit acting in 1995 and go back to his first love of photography. I love that adult Tommy, played by John Shepherd, has a photo of, you know, his sister Trish, his mom Mrs. Jarvis, and Gordon the dog from the final chapter. Again, it's a nice connection, again reminding the audience that this is who this character is. But Tommy's got a knife. I bet that's going to come into play at some point in the movie. And then we meet the great character, Reggie the Reckless. And we also see, again, I think a really nice touch, that adult Tommy has the same masks that we saw him with in the first movie, including that alien mask that Corey Feldman wears in the first scene that we see him in Final Chapter. I love that. And there's lots of shots of John Shepherd as Tommy Jarvis throughout this movie, of him just sort of looking ominously out of windows. And it's a very Norman Bates-esque performance, I think. Although John Shepherd, the way he put it, he said he was trying to channel Boo Radley from To Kill a Mockingbird, which I can see that too. We're introduced to the wonderful characters of Ethel N. Jr., redneck mother and son, played by Carol Locatelle and Ron Sloan. Carol Locatelle is phenomenally hilarious in this movie. She is so committed. She was a theater actor. You can tell because she has given it her all. And just has no fear of going over the top. She's like, "Oh, you want me to be this stereotypical redneck hag? I'm gonna go for it." And she does. God bless her. She starred in many plays on Broadway, including Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo, The Shadow Box, Neil Simon's Broadway Bound, in a ton of TV in guest roles, including Bonanza, MASH, The Practice, Seventh Heaven, Touched by an Angel, all the way up to Scandal. She was also in three movies with Burt Reynolds, none of which I have seen, but they are called Paternity, Best Friends, and Sharky's Machine. And in the latter movie, Sharky's Machine, Carol Locatelle wore this short, curly, weird wig, and she wore it to her audition for Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, or Repetition, as they thought it was called at the time. And the casting director and producer and the director loved this wig that she brought in and asked her to wear it for the movie. And I guess she thinks that maybe the wardrobe department forgot that it was actually her wig because she didn't get it back. They made her use her own wig and then stole it. And then the production team basically stole it from her. She improvised a lot of the scenes that she has. And she said that the improvisation for the character of Ethel just inevitably added more and more profanity to it. Which is so funny. We're going to talk more about the extensive profanity in this film a little bit later. Carol Locatelle died of cancer at age 82 very, very recently. She died on April 11th, 2023. But, huge body of work, but will always be cherished by horror fans for her work as Ethel Hubbard in this movie. And we have, again, a callback to the tropes that have been established of the police stopping by and basically being like, we don't like what y'all are doing around these parts kind of thing. And an interesting thing to note at this juncture is that so far, the first Friday the 13th movie is the only movie so far that is actually set at Camp Crystal Lake itself. Parts 2 and 3 are adjacent to Camp Crystal Lake, as in, like, their location, they're still on the lake itself, but, you know, at different points of the lake, not the camp from the first movie. The final chapter is in the general area of Camp Crystal Lake, somewhere near it. But the setting here in A New Beginning seems to be a totally different place, or definitely in the vicinity, but definitely not at the camp. So that's an interesting thing to keep in mind, because I think a lot of people who are coming to the Friday the 13th series for the first time assume that, oh, every movie is about camp, set at Camp Crystal Lake, and these dumb kids going back to the same camp over and over. And that's actually not true. Only the first movie is set at the actual camp so far, anyway. All right. We have new characters that we're introduced to. We have Dominic Brascia as Joey, who reminds me a lot of the character of Shelley from Friday the 13th Part 3. And also Mark Venturini as Vic, who's also in the movie The Return of the Living Dead, which came out the same year as this movie, both in 1985. And 21 minutes into this movie, Vic kills Joey in a fit of rage. Splits his chest open with an axe. And I think this is the first non-Mrs. or Jason Voorhees kill in the franchise. And there's a really great shot of the close-up of the ambulance siren as the ambulance is driving to the scene. And we get the information, which is going to be important for plot later, for reasons, that as far as Dr. Letter knows, Joey has no immediate family. His mother is dead. His father took off somewhere. No one knows where he is. We also in this scene meet the character of Roy Burns, the paramedic, played by Dick Wyand, who's shocked by Joey's death and seems to be the only authority figure who cares. He's like, as the gory remains of Joey are uncovered, the other paramedic blows, bubble gum as all these teenagers are around crying and says, like, what a bunch of pussies. And I think that it introduces a key element to this movie as well that hasn't necessarily existed in the franchise before now. And I think it's another reason why fans can get a little put off by it, is that there's a lot of very black comedy in this movie. A lot of, you might say, tasteless or crude comedy in this movie that has not existed in the previous four, which adds an interesting element to it. So, okay, we have a kid killed at this place by another teenager. I think this is what they call in screenwriting school an inciting incident. All right, we're going to get back to the movie, my friends. You're going to pause when it reaches 46 minutes and 25 seconds. See you when clock says 46 minutes, 25 seconds. Enjoy. All right, welcome back. So we're introduced to, again, a couple of characters that we've never seen before, and after a few minutes, we're never going to see again. The characters of Pete and Vinny, played by Corey Parker and Anthony Burrell. Now, Cory Parker is actually a member of the Actors Studio and is today a very highly regarded and respected acting teacher. Anthony Baril was also theater actor, was in the original Broadway cast of The Who's Tommy. And even though we only see these characters for a short while, and this is really true of all the sort of random characters that are brought in to be killed, it's interesting the way this movie is structured, in that basically these characters who are unrelated to the main action or plot at all are brought in and basically have their own little scene, like almost a little like short, like, you know, 5-10 minute play where they are the stars and get to have fun and create these very out there, you might say, like stereotypical characters, and then they die. But they all kind of get their little moments to shine, which I think, again, like, some people don't like that aspect of this film. I actually really do, because it gives everyone something memorable to do and to play, even if it's only for a couple minutes before they end up dying. Character of Pete has the great line, "As far as I'm concerned, all those loonies should be killed off one by one." Which, of course, is exactly what's happening in this movie. Vinny gets the very memorable kill, a road flare, burning road flares inserted into his mouth. And just as a clue, think, who might have access to a road flare? As we are getting into this movie, it's like, who is Jason? Think about that. Now we have Tommy, you know, waking up from a nightmare, shirtless and sweaty, and going to the mirror, you know, trying to take his medication, and then sees the apparition of Jason in the mirror for a moment, and then he disappears. And John Shepherd, bless his soul, in interviews has talked about, like, the deep meaning of that scene of, like, you know, seeing and, you know, the monster that could be inside you and all this stuff, which, sure, yeah, we'll go with that. All joking aside, I really do respect how seriously John Shepherd took his work in this movie, and it really shows. It's a better movie because of his dedication, but he is alone in that kind of actorly dedication in this film, and that's okay. We also have Vernon Washington as Reggie's grandfather, George. Vernon Washington was also in the movie The Last Starfighter, also in the miniseries Roots, The Next Generations. This is his final film role. We're introduced to John Robert Dixon as the character of Eddie, who scares Tommy by stealing one of his masks, and then Tommy body slams him onto a table, which is an interesting moment because it shows us that Tommy is prone to these fits of rage and is very physically strong as well, which, think about that. And we're back at, oh, bless it, Ethel and Junior's house, where we get some more wonderful dialogue, including the immortal line that Carol Locatell says, "You big dildo, eat your fucking slop." Brand new sentence. And if you look closely at, like, the stuff that Junior's eating, it looks disgusting. It looks like a bowl of vomit. I have no... What is that? Who knows? Now, it's interesting in this film. There is so much profanity in this movie, like, and it, where it, there are points when, like, literally almost every other word is fuck, and there's just so much cursing in almost every scene in this film that it reaches a level of absurdity that is hilarious. Like, it's almost like South Park before its time in the amount of cursing there is. And you can tell it's because this movie's trying to be edgy and adult, and, like, we're giving you all this stuff, you know, lots of nudity and cursing and killing and drugs. But it just comes across as really funny to me. That's one of the things I enjoy a lot. great scene, you know, after Pete and Vinny's corpses are discovered, Sheriff says, "What the hell's going on here?" Roy, the paramedic, says, "Are you talking to me?" Looks like we got ourselves a maniac on the loose, the law enforcement says. Then we have a scene with two characters that are basically set up to die, named Lana and Billy. Lana's played by Rebecca Wood. Billy is played by Bob DeSimone. Interestingly, this one scene with the characters Lana and Billy was originally written for Friday the 13th, the final chapter, but was never filmed for some reason. No one knows why. And they just plopped it into the script for Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, because it was easy to do so. Like I said, it really is like its own like five to 10 minute like little play, you know, with these two characters who then die. Rebecca Wood has a very memorable moment where she's getting ready to Billy. She's looking at herself in the mirror and she rips open her shirt to expose her breasts to the mirror and us and says, "It's showtime." And that wasn't in the script. That moment was her idea because she had seen the movie All That Jazz, which is about Bob Fosse, who would often say, "It's showtime," with jazz hands. And she went up to Danny Steinman, the director, and was like, "Hey, I have this idea. What if I open my shirt, you know, and exposing my breast and say, 'It's showtime.'" And Danny Steinman, of course, loved that idea, so they did it. Now, Lana gets killed with an axe to her head, and after they filmed that, Rebecca Wood has said that she walked her down the street, like, with that sort of axe in the head, makeup still in, like, acting like a zombie and freaking, you know, people out on the road. She seems really fun, like, in all the interviews that she's done about her role in this film since. Then we have Tommy seeing another vision of Jason. As he's looking out the window, Jason is down on the ground. And when this was filmed, it's Tom Morga as Jason in this scene looking up at the house. But Tom Morga wasn't looking at John Shepard as Tommy. John Shepard is Tommy's reaction shots were filmed later. Tom Morga was looking up at another crew member who decided to moon him to try and make him laugh during that scene. And we finally have the mayor's coming to the sheriff's office trying to get to the bottom of this, gotta stop these murders. And that is when the sheriff says, "I think it's Jason Voorhees," the whole name for the first time. And we also get the information that Jason Voorhees, after his death in the final chapter, was cremated. Keep that thought in your hat. Jason Voorhees was cremated. That might come in. We might have some continuity issues moving forward. Then we have a sex scene in the woods between Eddie and Tina, and there's a whole big drama around this scene. Originally, so first of all, this was Deborah Voorhees who plays Tina. She filmed the sex scene and her death scene her first day of filming, or the first scenes that she did for this movie, both of which required her to be fully nude. And originally, this sex scene between Eddie and Tina was much, much longer, the way that director Danny Steinman originally shot it. Went on for minutes of them having sex. Like you said, I shot a fucking porno in the woods out there. But Danny Steinman has said that his reasoning for that, why he wanted to do that, is that in the you know, because this is a pretty crazy movie. Like, there's a lot of people dying. There's a lot of sort of trashiness and crudeness, I guess you could call it that. But he wanted, in the middle of this movie, which, like, we're pretty much in the middle of the movie at this point, this sort of moment of beauty of these two young people being, you know, having sex together, and, you know, it being a beautiful thing, a moment of calm. Which, honestly, I buy that. Like, I buy that as a reasoning for doing that, and I think that could have really worked. But, of course, it was very graphic. Frank Mancuso Jr., as executive producer, was like said to editor Bruce Green, cut it, make it look like a Pepsi commercial, which is why, you know, the sex scene seemed like Eddie and Tina start having sex. The sort of strange drifter character who's in this film for like a minute is killed by Jason. And then you cut back to them and they're done. But you can tell it's so, so abrupt. And it's very obvious that there was supposed to be more there originally. Now, also Deborah Voorhees, you know, with the... After she's been killed, you know, she gets the garden shears through the eyes, which is a brutal one. And then she had to, you know, get the makeup, get the blood makeup on her eyes so they could shoot the scene where Eddie discovers her murdered body. Again, she's completely nude. So they took her to the makeup trailer. She was still naked, just wearing a robe, got this bloody eye stuff applied to her, and she could not see anything, was led back to the woods, and they took the robe off. She's laying there completely naked, completely exposed. And she said they filmed her for a while, and like, it was strange that, like, she, because she couldn't see, she had no idea, like, what parts of her were being filmed, what was being seen or not, because, again, she is fully nude. And she also said the blood burned her eyes very, very badly. Yeah. And then the kill of Eddie is so great. I mean, first of all, it's ridiculous. They have sex and he's like, I gotta go wash up, and leaves her there. It's like, what? But it's, you know, literally, obviously, just because the script says so, because they need them to be killed separately. We're not going for logic here, especially not in this Friday the 13th movie. The kill of Eddie, I think, is one of the most creative in the entire franchise. Like, having the leather belt, you know, around his eyes, and then twisted tighter and tighter and tighter on the trunk of this tree until you basically like crush his skull. And of course, the MPAA cuts, I am sure, a lot of that gore effect that was done, but like, even cut down, it still packs a punch. It's really good. Really, really good. And then after he dies, the camera lingers on a raven that is the only witness to this murder, and then the raven flies away. And now we're going to continue watching the movie. We're going to watch till we get to 1 hour, 11 minutes, and 15 seconds. Refresh your popcorn, your libations, whatever you're enjoying watching this movie. And when we get to 1 hour, 11 minutes, and 15 seconds, I will see you again, or hear you again. Okay, it is finally nighttime. So we know that we're going into the final act of this film, the night when most of the massacre is going to happen. And we're introduced to Reggie, the wonderful Reggie the Reckless, in his signature red jumpsuit. The actor who played Reggie has said that they had many, many copies of this red jumpsuit because basically most of the rest of this movie is filmed with them running around in the rain. And he has said in interviews that he likes to think that with the jumpsuit was red because he was washed in the blood of Jesus. Because remember, he later on became a pastor. We meet Reggie's older brother, the... imaginatively named Demon, who lives at the local trailer park. Demon is played by Miguel A. Nunez Jr., who also played the role of Spider in The Return of the Living Dead, also came out this year, in the same year this movie was made, 1985, along, as I mentioned earlier, with the actor Mark Venturini, who played Vic, the guy that rage kills Joey and sets off all the killings in A New Beginning. How cool is that, that in the same year you appear in two famous horror movies of the 1980s. In one movie, you're playing a character named Demon. In the other movie, you're playing a character named Spider. here for it. Demon's girlfriend, Anita, is played by J.R. Fields, who as a child actor, appeared in a lot of TV, including episodes of The Brady Bunch. Also, as she got older, did voice work for cartoons, including the Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo show, and eventually retired from acting to become a social worker. I love that the dinner that that Demon and Anita are having consists of enchiladas, tacos, egg rolls, pizza, and beer. It's quite a combination. You had to order from at least three different places to get all those items. I love the weird scene of Tommy out in the parking lot being sort of drawn to and hypnotized by this green flickering electricity of the trailer park neon sign. Very, very David Lynch, Twin Peaks The Return, reminds me of. Then Junior, Redneck Junior son, shows up on his motorcycle, and Tommy beats the shit out of Junior. And then later on, after Reggie and Pam and Tommy are gone, Demon and Anita are alone. Demon starts not feeling too well in his tummy and says, "Those damn enchiladas," and runs out to the tin outhouse of the trailer park. And, you know, I'm amazed for, like, where just the kind of movie that this is. I'm amazed that there's not, like, farting and shitting sound effects in that scene. It honestly surprises me with, like, as sort of sleazy and crude as Danny Steinman's directorial style is in this film. And I'm not saying that as a negative at all. I'm here for it. I love it. It just surprises me that they held that back. I think that would have been really, really, really funny. Says, again, a great line, "This shit box is gross." And then there's, in contrast to all that, there's a really sweet moment, actually, between Demon and Anita where they're singing to each other. It's such a beautiful moment. It's kind of an oasis in the middle of this insanity. But then we hear Anita gasp, and then Demon is speared to death on the toilet. Again, two characters that we basically meet for one scene, but, like, they really establish themselves, have some great moments, great lines, and then memorable deaths. It's not a bad gig, like, for the actors in this film. Like, sure, they don't get a lot of screen time, but the little bit of screen time they get is very memorable and impactful. Junior is later beheaded on his motorcycle, and this was another. And we see his severed head flop to the ground. And this was another thing that the MPAA really, really, you know, was sticklers on. They're like, for an R rating, the head cannot bounce more than once, which is weird. But okay. And then, oh, sadly, Ethel has to die too. She gets a meat cleaver that it comes through the window and into her head, and then she face plants into the pot of stew she's making. And if you look closely, that is probably the biggest, like, cooking pot I have ever seen in my life. It is enormous, and it appears to be sitting in the sink. She's assembling the stew in the sink. For some reason, I guess. R.I.P. Ethel. R.I.P. Carol Locatelli. And then, oh, it's storm time. The thunderstorm starts. So, you know, we're getting into the final bit now. We have two other characters who have been at Pinehurst that they've had lines. They've been in some scenes, but this is really their showcase scene together. Jake and Robin. Jake played by Jerry Pavlon. Robin played by Juliet Cummins. And they're sitting watching TV, and it's such an interesting choice that the movie that they're watching is A Place in the Sun, and a main plot point of that film is someone dies by drowning in a lake, like Jason Voorhees was supposed to have done. So again, nice little Easter egg there. Jake, who has a little bit of a speech, like a speech impediment, says he likes Robin, he really likes Robin, he wants to make love with Robin. Robin laughs at him, and Jake said, I didn't mean it, I was just kidding. And it's like, aw, sad. And then Jake, of course, goes upstairs and is killed. Robin, after taking her shirt off and exposing her breasts for no real reason, goes to bed and finds the corpse of Jake in her bed and is then killed with a machete from below. Another, again, nod back to Kevin Bacon in the first movie. Because that's such a good kill. And then the character of Violet, played by Tiffany Helm. So we talked about how in the final chapter, Crispin Glover just has an iconic dance scene. Violet's dance in A New Beginning is not Crispin Glover level, because it's not possible to be weirder than Crispin Glover. But her dance scene is equally strange and wonderful, with her kind of doing the robot to this song, and it's a great moment. It is, again, a peak 80s moment. Like, the character of Violet, played by Tiffany, like it quintessential sort of weird quasi goth 80s girl, like, with just very, very like early Madonna, actually, I would say is a really good visual for her. Like, just the crimped blonde hair, the makeup, the lipstick, the clothes, like, God, I love the 80s. Anyway, this film came out the year I was born, incidentally, 1985, which may be a reason why I'm a slightly partial to it. I don't know why, but ever since I was a little kid, really loved movies that came out in 1985. I don't know why. So, Reggie the Reckless discovers a pile of bloody corpses in Tommy's room. Tommy has been missing for a while. Is it because he's killing people? Maybe. Pam comes, and they're like, let's get the fuck out of here. Let's get out of this house, which is a smart decision. And then Jason literally bursts through an entire closed door, which is a really badass moment. And then then Reggie and Pam are running through the woods in the rain, and through all this sequence, at the running around the woods sequences, keep a close eye on Pam, because she's got wearing a white shirt, she's got a pink sweater wrapped around her, but from shot to shot, sometimes the pink sweater will disappear, and then the very next shot it will return, then it will disappear. Keep an eye on it. It's a really, really funny continuity error. Drives the Melanie the actor crazy. She hates that, and she hated that pink sweater, she said. We find the paramedic truck, and they find Dr. Letter dead inside of it, and we see Jason. A really important thing about this moment is that we see Jason in the mask. And we see that Jason has clearly human eyes, does not appear to be all disfigured and monstrous looking under that mask. Who is behind this mask? We're going to watch till the end of the movie, and we're going to find out. See you after the credits, friends. So Melanie Kinneman, who plays Pam, again, because the last bit of this movie is basically like her and Reggie running around in the pouring rain. She said that this is her favorite part of the film, in spite of the case of the disappearing pink and reappearing pink sweater, because she said she hated the way she actually looked in the movie, but she loves how she looks wet. In this final sequence, because she thinks she looks good, like, soaking wet. I promise I didn't mean that as double entendre. But again, eventually the pink sweater does disappear for good, and you can guess the reason why when you watch this latter half of the film, because she is wearing a white button-down shirt, and you can clearly see everything under that shirt when she's soaking wet. I'm sure that was the intention of the designer. Again, we have the ubiquitous corpse thrown through the window. It is Grandpa thrown through the window. We see him with his eyes gouged out. You know, even though there are 22 dead bodies in this movie, there's actually a significant portion of these murders that happen off screen, and we just see corpses later, which is interesting. I find it, I mean, not funny, but weird that, like, when Jason catches up to Pam basically, like, lays down to die, like, is laying on the ground, like, actually has this expression on her face of, like, okay, fine. But then Reggie comes to the rescue and runs Jason over with a tractor. Great, great moment. And that, it's an interesting, interesting thing about this film is that we haven't seen in a while, is that Jason takes injuries in A New Beginning. You know, he's been injured before in previous movies, you know, like getting a machete, like cutting through half his hand, but in those movies, just kind of like looks at it like, oh, and then continues on his way. But this Jason in A New Beginning, you see him actually be injured and get hurt. Like, you can see that he's in pain and becomes more and more debilitated as time goes on. Then you have we're back to a barn again. Again, like a setting that we've seen in previous films. And we're back here again. That amazing chainsaw machete, basically like sword fight-esque duel with a machete and chainsaw instead between Pam and Jason. This scene was actually filmed on Halloween night of 1984. And I have to say it, you know, this franchise in its first four movies has had some pretty badass final girls. These are women who are really, really fighting. Pam in A New Beginning sucks at fighting. Like, the chainsaw stops working and she basically is like, eh, and then like sort of throws it at Jason, but like not at him at all, just like aside. And like, she's not very good at fighting. But you know who is? Reggie the Reckless. Reggie the Reckless is the real star of this movie, I maintain. But we finally have Tommy Jarvis coming back. God knows where he's been. Tries to face his fear of seeing Jason, ends up getting sliced in the chest, but uses that pocket knife we saw in his very first scene near the beginning of the movie, uses that pocket knife to stab Jason through an artery in the leg. Told you that knife was going to be used. You can't have knife for no reason. And finally, Jason is finally killed, and it is revealed that Jason is Roy. Roy Burns, the paramedic played by Dick Wyand, whose son Joey was killed by Vic near the beginning of the movie, who has been wearing a mask over his face and then the hockey mask on top of it. And the hypothesis is that, and this is where this movie pisses people off, it doesn't piss me off because it's so stupid, I can't take it seriously, and I just kind of go with it. Like, it feels appropriate for what the rest of this movie is. Like, nothing about this movie is serious. Everything about this movie is over the top and crazy. And sure, yeah, it's this paramedic dude. It's the paramedic dude who we learn, you know, because the sheriff explains it after he dies. Like, we learned that Roy was actually the kid Joey's dad, but Joey never knew that. No one knew that. And then after Joey dies, Roy just decides to go crazy and murder everybody in sight. Like, it'd make more sense if he was just killing like the people at Pinehurst, like the people at the organization where his son was murdered. But no, he doesn't even start his killing spree by killing someone at Pinehurst. He starts by killing some completely random other characters and kills a shit ton of other completely random other characters. It makes zero sense. And Oh, and they try and make it make sense with, like, oh, he has these, they find newspaper clippings about Jason in his wallet, and that's why he's Jason Voorhees. That doesn't make any sense either, because in this world, it's canon that Jason Voorhees is dead and has been dead and cremated, no less, 5 years ago. So why would he try and cover his identity by being Jason Voorhees? Like, it makes no sense. Embrace it. Embrace the fact that it makes no sense. It's okay. Honestly, I do have to say, though, that this movie, and I credit a lot to director Danny Steinman, it actually does a very good job of giving you clues that Roy is the killer, that Roy is the Jason of this film. If you go back and watch this movie a second time, this movie doesn't cheat in the fact that of the killer's identity. Like, there are many subtle little moments where once you know that Roy is Jason and you go back and watch it again, like, there are moments, like, just out in the open, like, oh, of course it's him. I talked about a couple of them throughout this episode, but there are many others. So it plays fair. It, as a mystery, as a whodunit, it plays fair with its audience in that way. It's the motivation for why Roy is Jason and is killing all and kills all these people. The motivation makes absolutely no sense, but the identity of him being the killer makes sense with what the movie has shown you. Okay, so finally we're back to Tommy Jarvis, who has a dream about killing Pam and then laughing maniacally. And then he sees a vision of the real Jason. And this is, I think, one of the genuinely kind of creepy moments in this movie. Because the fake Jason, Roy, you know, it has the hockey mask with the blue diamonds, as we've seen. But you can clearly see, like, the human eyes behind the mask. But when you see Tommy's visions of Jason, and it's especially notable in this final scene where you see no human eyes behind the mask, it's just these black, empty pools of darkness in the eyes. And something that I think is a brilliant choice, and I didn't notice it for a while until I'd seen this movie a couple times. If you notice the music in this scene where Tommy sees Jason, decides to become Jason, puts on Roy's blue hockey mask. We're not gonna try and explain why that is in Tommy's room. It just is, okay, because the script says so. But listen to the music during this scene. It is the classic Friday the 13th music by Harry Manfredini, which, as we talked about in the first episode covering the first movie, is derived from the lines "Killer mommy, killer, ki ma." If you listen closely to the music in this scene, it changes as ki 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 ta ta ta, killer Tommy, killer Tommy, because Tommy is the new Jason Voorhees. That was one of Danny Steinman's two directives for this film, is that it had to have a kill every 8 minutes, and in the end, Tommy had to become Jason Voorhees, and he does, and kills Pam, and that is the end of the movie. It's so interesting to think about where this franchise could have gone if they had stuck to what they put down here, that the original Jason Voorhees is dead. Sure, and then there is an imposter, but now Tommy Jarvis has taken on the mantle of Jason in the hockey mask and is going to become a serial killer. Like, we don't ever get to see that play out, because fans reacted, as many still do today, reacted very unfavorably to this film in that there's no real Jason in it. And again, I've already talked about why I think that is stupid. I mean, everyone has the right to their own opinion, but like, I think this is such an enjoyable movie. It, as I said, this movie does what it says on the tin. Like, it is a new beginning. It is something different. Going back to the whodunit of the first film, having a lot more nudity, many more murders, a lot of profanity and lots of coke, both on screen and off. It's a different flavor. It was meant to go in a new direction, and I would have been very interested to see what would have happened if they had stuck to that. But they decided to go a different way. Dick Wyand, who played Roy in this film, said later, "It wasn't until I saw part 5 that I realized what a piece of trash it was. I knew the series' reputation, but you always hope yours will come out better." Ow. Now, this movie has a reputation for being a financial failure, and that's actually not true. This movie debuted at number 1 at the box office the weekend it came out. Again, it was made for like $2.2 million, and its opening weekend alone, it grossed $8 million. And on the Monday after the opening weekend, Frank Mancuso Jr. called Danny Steinman, the director, and congratulated him and said that these numbers, this amount of money opening weekend was like the golden years of the franchise. But it's only later on in hindsight where things began to sour, because this movie did make $22 million. However, that, which is still amazing, amazing profit, but did make, that is $10 million less than Friday the 13th, the final chapter made. So that's a pretty big drop. 10 million less is a pretty big drop. So they decided it was time to course correct the franchise. And so for the 6th movie, they decided to go somewhere completely different again. And we're going to watch that next week. I'm not going to give anything more away. Thank you so much for joining me again on this Hitchens on Horror deep dive into the Friday the 13th series. I hope you're having as much fun as I am revisiting these movies again, watching them, and learning all about the history and making of trivia behind the Camp Crystal Lake massacre. We'll see you next week for Friday the 13th, Part 6. Jason Lives. It's going to be a lot of fun. Again, I think all these movies are a lot of fun. And thank you so much for listening, my friends. If you want to learn more about my work, you can visit my website, joshhitchens.com. And don't forget to tell your friends about Hitchens on Horror. See you next week.